Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. You've probably heard of the circadian rhythm, but did you know that not just people and roosters have circadian rhythms? In fact, plants have circadian rhythms. We have circadian rhythms in all sorts of creatures, critters. We have circadian rhythms, for example, in plants, fungi. How about blue-green algae? Although their preferred noun nowadays is cyanobacteria. Got to change with the times. Circadian rhythm has certain properties, which we should probably start with. First of all, it's endogenous. That means it's intrinsic, literally hardwired into the mammalian cell. If you take a mammal or even a mammal's cell in cell culture and put it in a place with no changes in the environment of temperature or light, it will still maintain a 24-hour cycle. But that cycle is entrainable, meaning it does listen to the environment for cues on how it's doing and for resets. Well, a whole bunch of science, in fact, a whole branch of science called chronobiology, has grown up in the years since Hall, Robosch, and Young first identified the circadian cycle and some of its genes in fruit flies and figured out how this works. And it's a fascinating set of nested feedback loops, and we'll be talking about in just a few moments. But first, a few teasers. For example, the mitochondria are deeply involved with the circadian rhythm. And there's a form of medicine now called chronotherapeutics because it turns out that oncology cancer drugs work best at certain times at the cell cycle. It's kind of like those early morning attacks in a battle. If you can get the cancer cells when they're busy or asleep, they're more likely to be destroyed. Also, programmed cell death. That's the, when the senescent cells in our body go out on the metaphoric ice floe to die rather than hang around and consume resources. That also is chronotropic. There is a lot that's been learned about clock genes, and we're going to talk about these clock genes quite a bit in a few moments. But I thought I would share with you a little bit about the human typical chronobiology, and this is very interesting. So we're going to use for our body clock here a person who rises in the morning around 6:30 or 7, eats lunch around noon, and gets to bed about 10 o'clock. Not such bad advice anyway. Just before the person wakes up, and so we're going to use for our putative standard issue human, a 6:45 just before they wake up. And that's when the sharpest rise in blood pressure occurs. And that happens because there's a kick of adrenaline. Said human opens their eyes and starts moving around. Light hits the back of their retina, and about a half an hour or less after they open their eyes, all melatonin secretion stops. And by the way, about 16 hours later, that melatonin's going to get going again. The highest probability of a bowel movement is another hour later, and the highest testosterone secretion, and we all kind of know what that creates a probability for, will hit about a half an hour later. Highest alertness in the typical is around 10 a.m., which is a good reason to shift school start times back a little bit, and that's being done in many communities in the light of this research. Best coordination, around 2:30 in the afternoon. Fastest reaction time, about 3:30, around the time that high school's over and you're hitting the practice field. The greatest cardiovascular efficiency and muscle strength, about 5 p.m. The highest blood pressure, 6:30 p.m. The highest body temperature, about 9 p.m., around 7 p.m. And at 9 p.m., remember this is a person going to bed at 10, melatonin secretion starts to ramp up, and a little button clicks over in the colon, and bowel movements are suppressed. Our deepest sleep, it's about 2 in the morning, and our lowest body temperature, around 4:30, just before the whole thing gets revved up again. And remember when I said that the circadian rhythm has issues with entrainment, that it is entrainable? Well, the main entrainment in humans is daylight. And, we've been messing around with that concept of daylight. You may remember some science a few years ago. Maybe I learned this, this would have been probably 20 years ago, where they were talking about how actually people didn't have a 24-hour body clock. It was more like 26 hours. You had to reset it. Well, it turns out that was based on a false premise, which was not acknowledging the importance of artificial light. In fact, if you take people and confine them to natural light, they're about 24 hours, give or take, 20 minutes, so much closer than 26 hours. The problem was in the original studies, they let people, if they woke up in the middle of the night, they let them turn on their bedside light. And that, of course, messed up the clock because it reduced melatonin. Even small amounts of light can do that. And it prolonged the body clock. So I wonder, and again, we're seeing so much research now where what's wrong with the research is, we forgot to test women, or, we allowed for artificial light when we were studying sleep cycles. So many premises, basic premises, which will prove to be flawed, and we'll have to redo our science all over again. Just to digress, well, it's not really a digression, but just to elaborate for a moment on that light blind spot that we all have. About 10 years ago, in an effort to improve energy efficiency and reduce electrical consumption, there were some regulations that went into place. If you were going to put in new light fixtures in a house, if you had a remodel, you weren't allowed to put in old-fashioned incandescent receptors anymore. You were going to have to put in halogen, you know, high, better energy use, supposedly. Well, the halogen actually is also brighter, and it tends to suppress sleep and mess with the cycle. And around 1997, we started getting Facebook and smartphones and all sorts of things that allowed us to, basically web surf in bed, which was using devices that were blue light LEDs. And so we began systematically messing with our body clocks, and we have a whole generation of people who have never really had a chance to establish a really good sleep-wake cycle. At least that flashlight that I used to read under the covers when I was cheating at home when I was a child in the 60s was a regular incandescent bulb and didn't mess me up nearly as much as the stuff that children are currently reading. The French Agency for Food, Environmental Health, and Occupational Safety just released some warnings about LED light, and very impressive scientifically. But one of the new findings that really got my attention was talking about the phototoxic effects of high-intensity blue light and the fact that there's an increased risk of age-related macular degeneration, a horrible kind of blindness where you can still see as if you were about 2300, so you can still see shadows and avoid walls, but you can't read and you really can't watch screens or operate any interfaces. So imagine that, can't use your phone. Age-related macular degeneration is a leading cause of vision loss among people over the age of 50, and rates have been increasing. The French agency is postulating that this may have something to do with the increased amount of bright blue light. And in the research, at least for macular degeneration, the blue light filters, the stuff, the little apps that you can put on your phone, do not work. LEDs are getting into everything. They're in toys. They're in all of the newest flashlights. They're in the car headlights now. And these are all the bright blue, very energy efficient LEDs that I'm talking about. It's kind of an unpleasant light. And so many of us have, after switching to LEDs, went, eh, and then moved to the warm white domestic LED lighting, which is currently available. That lighting is actually much lower in phototoxicity risks. It's rated as about the same as incandescent. So if you are buying new light bulbs for your home, definitely, if you go LED, go with the warm white. And I'm encouraging, if you buy Christmas lights even, do us all a favor and choose the warm white lights, because that's going to filter in through your windows. The problem with the blue light, the cool blue light in particular, is it goes straight to the suprachiasmatic place in the hypothalamus. So that's where the body clock comes from. The body clock lives there in the suprachiasmatic nucleus, and it receives signals directly from the retina. In fact, this is a very adapted system, so early adapted, in fact, that you can you don't even need rods or cones. So if you are at the level of the photoreceptor of, say, a worm, this will entrain your, this is how old the body clock is. It's in fact so old that cyanobacteria use it, although they use a somewhat different form. We'll come to the grandfather clock in a while in this discussion. But what I wanted to just drift into here is that the cells that we call ganglion cells in the retina, which don't even see light in a traditional way, but are used kind of in as an interconnection, extension cord, cord splitter function in the human retina with its very, very detailed layers of rods and cones. In more primitive organisms, that's it. That's the photoreceptor. That's where this signal originates, and there are neurons that go directly to the suprachiasmatic nucleus. They don't travel in the same pathway of the optic nerve. And when they get to the hypothalamus, they cause the hypothalamus to send a signal to the pineal gland to release or inhibit the release of melatonin, which is the sleep hormone. And it is intensely related to light. Now, aging plays a role here, too. If you're very young or you're very old, you are more sensitive to blue light for completely different reasons. In the case of children and teenagers, their lenses don't filter blue light very well. And so more of this blue light is going to get to their hypothalamus and mess up their sleep. In the case of elders, as we age, there's a protein breakdown product called lipofuscin. And these are molecules of broken rods and cones, effectively. This lipofuscin is still a pigment molecule, and it fluoresces in blue light. So it exaggerates the effect of blue light on the ganglion cells and hence the sleep cycle. So this increased light sensitivity may be part of the reason, or a lot of the reason, why it's harder to stay asleep when you're older. And for elders, and particularly I would say people who are having problems with sleep phase, getting rid of that blue light is really, really important. The French agency does state that yellow-tinted glasses, the so-called wraparound blue blocker dorky sunglasses, are good. Those are the ones that actually work. I can't remember his name, but I know there's one of the Avengers, Cyclops, maybe, who shoots, you know, these sort of incandescent laser beams out of his eyes and has to walk around with a visor on. Well, we're all going to be walking around with those visors in the evening if we want to protect ourselves from blue light and we're in an environment where we don't have control. So let's go delve back into the history of this thing. Turns out the first mention of the circadian clock goes back to the 4th century BC, when a ship captain serving under Alexander the Great, who was transporting some tamarind trees from newly captured territories, no doubt, and had them in the hold of the ship, noticed that the trees were opening and closing their leaves on a 24-hour cycle, even though it was very dark in there. Fast forward to the 13th century, which is the first notation of the diurnal cycle. And by the way, I can tell you as an acupuncturist, there is a whole huge thing about the body clock and how you do acupuncture treatments at certain times of the 24-hour cycle to have certain calculated effects on different meridians, which is, you know, just fascinating when we come to the stuff about the sympathetic and the parasympathetic systems. So a French scientist back in 1729 reported the same thing that the captain in the 4th century did, but he rediscovered it, I believe. And then it's about, so fast forward again to about 1900, when scientists in all over Europe basically discover that sleep deprivation, sleepiness, will cycle up and down in a 24-hour cycle, and that if you lock animals up in a cave, they'll still have a 24-hour activity cycle of sleeping and waking. Also, circadian rhythms were noticed around that time in the feeding times of bees. And so it wasn't until 1935 that the existence of circadian rhythm and a little bit of its mechanism was discovered in fruit flies. There was plenty of research, and it was about 1971 that the DNA, the genetics of this, and that it was in fact a genetic phenomenon was first identified. And that was by Konopa and Benzer. And they were using, of course, fruit flies. And around the same time, a Dr. Young identified that the size of the gene and where it was located. It's a 7.1 kilobase interval on the X chromosome. And this got them the 2017 DNA Prize in Physiology and Medicine. The human clock genes work in a similar way. I mentioned earlier that we were going to go way back in time, having come forward from the 4th century. Let's go back 2.3 billion years to something called the Great Oxidation Event. And this is probably, I mean, as we look here at the, what do we call it, the Anthropocene era that we've entered into, well, the Great Oxidation Event is the first time that a life form on Earth poisoned itself. And in this case, it was, yes, you bet, the cyanobacteria. So essentially, prior to that, the bacteria didn't have the ability to generate oxygen. They didn't have photosynthesis, and the existence of early photosynthetic ecology created a whole lot of oxygen as a waste product. So in the process of turning carbon and water and sunlight into energy, carbohydrate, a lot of extra oxygen got kicked out. And oxygen, well, it's an oxidizing agent. It would go around and it would steal electrons from something. And when you steal electrons from something, it rusts. So the Great Oxidation Event was a mass die-off that killed off many of the existing one-celled life forms, but cleared the way for more elaborate oxygen technologies. Technologies is probably the wrong word when we're talking about bacteria, but more elaborate oxygen mechanisms that eventually lead to the chloroplast, and that from there you get the plants, and from there you get something for the multi-celled animals to eat. And away we go, fast forward to the present, where we are in fact burning up those early fossil fuels, like those early ferns and plants, and putting them in the atmosphere and creating a great CO2 event. So I love that there's this kind of planetary oscillation going on, because we're talking about oscillation and microcircuitry. The blue-green algae evolve. Oh, excuse me, the cyanobacterium evolve. They make lots of oxygen. The oxygen steals electrons and changes into water, but alters the body molecules of those other cells and creates free radicals. Now, we all know about free radicals. because they are what disrupt our DNA and our mitochondria. And around the time that we're getting the full-on plant chloroplasts, we're also getting this other structure called the mitochondria, which allows us to have multicellular life. Now, there is, in Drosophila, there's actually a gene that if it's defective, the Drosophila don't get a circadian rhythm. And in humans, that same gene, or the highly evolved analog of it, is responsible for an actual illness, a sleep disorder called familial advanced sleep phase syndrome, which, if you're going to describe what that looks like, it's basically work till you drop, sleep till you wake, work till you drop, sleep till you wake, because you have to, in order to sleep, you basically have to exhaust your body tissues until you're forced to sleep. So even in creatures as primitive as mollusks, there is a eye and a signal that travels to the brain. And, oh God, this weekend I was listening to a podcast all about Einstein's brain and talking about, was he really that smart? Was he just in the right place at the right time, as he always maintained? And, he was in that patent office, and there wasn't a lot of patents being filed, so he had plenty of time. And he was trying to get a job as a physicist anyway. So this was just his version of the barista gig while he was waiting for something better to come along. And there were trains and streetcars running around outside. And this is right at the time when time begins to be codified. So when Einstein was born, every town had its own time. It was just, local time. And local time was fixed by the town clock. Or maybe the watchmaker in town. He was the one who decided whether it was 5 till 2 or 5 after 2. And everybody went along with it. But then suddenly, railroads happened. And when you had an extensive transportation system with trains, you needed to have a schedule. So you knew to get to the railroad station by 2:10 to catch your train. Well, what if 2:10 is different? What if the town 5 minutes away has 5 till 2 as your 2:10? Well, you're going to miss the train. So instead, they had to actually standardize the clocks. And it was in thinking about standardization of time and faster than light travel that Einstein, who incidentally had a very, very unusually large density of neurons in the visuospatial part of the brain, the part of the brain that visualizes objects and things in space. If you flip the cube around and point the corner at you and tell you what it looks like. That kind of spinning stuff, his brain was especially good at. It would also have been really good at thought problems involving space-time. And so it was the idea of a photon moving at light speed. How does time catch up with that that led to special relativity? So how's that for a fun digression? Getting back to other things in animals. Okay, body core temperature, as I've already mentioned, changes. Brainwave activity, hormone production, cell regeneration, detoxification, physiologic. There are so many things that depend on this body clock. And as the seasons shift and the days get shorter, it's super important for animals to be able to reset their body clock so that they can be in sync with the environment and in sync with timing for migration, reproduction, and hibernation. And a lot of those things are keyed to the duration of the day. So, of course, we come to experiments on mutant mice. And what happens there is clock mutant mice take out the genes for the clock genes, and they're hyperphagic and obese. They eat too much, they get fat, they have a predisposition to diabetes, and we know that this happens in humans as well, particularly people who are shift workers. There's a lot of other biology that's fascinating, but I think the most important thing for us to talk about is that a little bit about the feedback loop before we get just practical here. There's such a wonderful, beautiful feedback loop, and I'm not going to go into detail, but I urge you to read the end of the Wikipedia article on circadian rhythm where they talk about this, because you actually, the loop is run by gene regulation. You make genes, Those genes actually are being manufactured. They're turning into proteins. The proteins are being shifted by a second protein. They're being the second protein is light sensitive. As long as there's light, that second protein is active. The minute the light goes away, the second protein stops working, and the sleep genes put themselves together and start inhibiting the clock and putting us to sleep. And I'm just going to read you this one phrase. Plant circadian rhythm is more advanced than humans, probably because they had more time to develop it. It is a triple negative component represillator model. And that's for the university's students in the audience, because I sure don't know what that means. Let's get practical here. If you exercise in the morning, you increase your parasympathetic tone. That's your rest and digest, and that helps you think more clearly. If you exercise in the evening, that raises your sympathetic tone. That raises your adrenaline, makes you more excitable, and kind of prevents you from going to sleep. So if you need to stay up late, scheduling an exercise program is an excellent way, and in the evening is an excellent way to do it. The microbiome actually talks to the clock genes. Little bits of signals from the microbiome go to the clock genes and affect your sleep. So if you have a dysbiosis or a bad microbiome, you're going to have more problems. Also, your diet can affect sleep. And if your diet is low in tryptophan, you won't be able to make as much melatonin. So you need at least 20% protein in your diet for optimum sleep. And melatonin is incredibly important. Not only does it regulate inflammation, it regulates allergies and autoimmune disease. So we know that inflammation, this is particularly in multiple sclerosis, but it's true in all autoimmune disease, inflammation peaks in the morning. And that's where you really want those clock genes to be working. Another way to reverse inflammation, and another thing during the day, when I say peaks in the morning, we're talking early morning, you know what stops it? Ultraviolet radiation. Even physically on the skin, getting sun on your skin is directly anti-inflammatory. And part of that is working through this clock gene to Treg, which are the Th17 cells, the regulatory cells that control those, the most pro-inflammatory cells that we have, are being turned off by sunlight. Before I go to emails, just wanted to throw this out. I got this memo from the California Medical Association. The AMA did a discussion, and I picked this up driving over here. At one point, they were talking about national health care and health care for all and various permutations of that. So let's talk about how great our current system isn't. And I'm going to talk about about prior authorization hurdles. This was a survey of 1,000 practicing physicians all over the country. And 91% said that prior authorization programs have a negative effect on patient clinical outcomes. Now, prior authorizations are where you have to get permission from the health insurers to give certain drugs or to do certain tests or to get certain treatments. And over a quarter, 28% of physicians in the survey reported that they had in their practice serious or life-threatening events at least once because of delay introduced by these prior authorizations. 65% have waited at least one business day. 26% have had to wait 3 business days or longer. I'm certainly in that percent. And sometimes the patients just give up on the treatment, which is recommended by their doctor, because the prior authorization is just taking too long. Or, and I think this is what they want, they just go pay for it themselves. And sometimes I've actually even suggested that when the cost of the drug was not too burdensome for the patient, because I was getting such pushback, usually because of their age or some other factor, where they were second-guessing my clinical judgment. Hey, guys, I'm on the hook. If there's a problem here, I'm the one the lawyers are going to come after. So why are you getting in the way here and making the patient not get the drug that I, the doctor, with all that knowledge of the patient and medicine, have decided is necessary? Every week, the average medical practice per doctor completes 31 prior authorization requirements. And that takes about 14.9 hours. Yep, that's about right. It's half an hour per prior auth in general. By the time you go through two or three levels of hold or fill out the form and then fill out the next form. And oh, look, you filled it out. You click return and a whole bunch of new questions pop up. Yeah, it's about half an hour. This takes 2 business days of physician and staff time, and more than one third of physicians employ a dedicated staff member who works exclusively on tasks associated with prior authorization. And if you're wondering where all the primary care doctors are going and why they're going into large multi-specialty groups, well, they're going so they don't have to do this crap. Because if you're in private practice, you end up spending a couple of hours a day after you've finished with your clinic on the phone or on the computer trying to get the things that your patients need and which, oh, by the way, they already paid for in the form of their insurance premium. Our first email comes from Troy in Monterey Bay, and Troy writes, he wants me to look at an article, Osteoporosis Breakthrough, Bone Mass Increased 800%. A fascinating new study finds that blocking estrogen in the brains of mice causes bone density to significantly be boosted well into old age. So these were, first of all, let's talk about mice. And mice are a substantial problem because they're not humans. These were at least female mice, which is why, by the way, nobody had noticed this before because they only do studies in male mice. They've only started. They're going to have to redo all of the mouse stuff now because they never did it in females. And you know what? Hormones actually act differently on the brains of mice. Who would have thunk? Anyway, what they did was they blocked estrogen in the brains of mice, and they were looking at a place in the good old hypothalamus again called the arcuate nucleus. And what they found was that as they completely blocked estrogen, the bones got stronger. They got stronger really quickly. One of the authors commented that they'd never seen bones this strong. These are all making me feel very non-fuzzy, warm and fuzzy about the concept of blocking estrogen in the hypothalamus of humans as a method for treating osteoporosis. It's fascinating basic science research, but boy, are we talking not ready for prime time. Moving to our next email, this from Frederick on the west side of Santa Cruz. And Frederick writes, gout. I've been taking allopurinol. I think Frederick was an earlier email that we covered maybe a few weeks ago. Greatly reduced the intake of red meat, no shellfish, getting rid of most dairy, and eat lots of veggies and fruit. I've lost weight, but the inflammation in the big toe and the ball of the foot continues. The scaling and dryness of the foot skin is gone, however. I've had this condition for 2 years, so I guess it will take that long to get rid of this condition, or is it something I have to live with? I'm male, 72 years old, and 20 pounds overweight. Well, Frederick, allopurinol is largely a preventative drug, not a curative drug. So you should be on something that will act as a uricosuric. That means something that will cause you to pee out increased amounts of uric acid, because it's the uric acid crystals in the joint that create the gout. And to get the crystals to melt, your bloodstream has to have a lower concentration of uric acid so that it's a kind of downhill trip for those crystals to dissolve in the fluid that they're bathing in. So things don't melt. If I have something that's what we call a supersaturated solution of salt, it's absorbed as much salt as it can absorb. I can't add more salt. If I add more salt, it just bunches up there on the bottom of the Erlenmeyer flask. It doesn't dissolve. So you need to engage in a little dilution. And the best way to do that, besides hydration, is a uricosuric. Indomethacin, this is a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory, is classically used as a uricosuric. But maybe you have had an ulcer or you have some other contraindication to the use of NSAIDs. So we're going to dust off a very, very old drug called probenecid. And probenecid is a uricosuric. It used to be given to people to increase the concentration of an antibiotic. I believe it was penicillin, because, you know, penicillin, if you take it orally, you have to take it four times a day. It really, your body gets rid of it very rapidly. And so if you added probenecid, you could reduce the frequency of the penicillin. This is ancient history. Very likely any doctor who was educated after 1995 or thereabouts never heard of it, because it's fallen out of favor. And who knows, there may be a a skrelic out there who's cornered the market on probenecid and it costs an arm and a leg. But assuming it's still out there and available as an inexpensive generic, I want to encourage you to think about asking your doctor to prescribe it. And they may have to look up the dose, but that won't be too bad. Top story, really, of the week is a successful elimination of all HIV from the genomes of living animals. About a year ago, I reported that researchers using CRISPR had been able to eliminate HIV from the white blood cells of mice. And this was the same, this is the same lab, which is Kamal Khalili, who's a professor of neuroscience, neurovirology, at the Lewis Katz School at Temple University. I skipped some of the cred because the guy's got a lot of stuff after his name. But one of the reasons it's been hard to get HIV out of people is we can suppress it with our antiretroviral therapy, but it hides in the DNA, very much the way chickenpox hides in the DNA to come out later as shingles. So as long as the antibody levels against chickenpox are high enough, it keeps it from coming out. But the minute those levels drop, or the person gets stressed or has another disease or gets chemo, boom, out it comes. Well, HIV is a bit like that. We take away the antiretroviral and it peeks out and comes out of hibernation. So you have to scrub it out of all of the cells that have it. But but CRISPR is only able to get to the white blood cells, and it can't get to all of the places. So what they did was they used a special therapeutic strategy called long-acting, slow-effective release ART, or antiretroviral therapy, and they combined that with the same CRISPR probe that they had used before. And it was it's fascinating because they took the old ART and they packaged it into nanocrystals. And these nanocrystals, nano things have really interesting properties. They readily went to all of the lymph tissues. That's where they want to go. They homed in on the lymph tissues, which is where the HIV is hiding, and slowly released drug over a long period of time. So no replication of the HIV, no new copies being made. And that gave CRISPR time to search through literally every single cell in the body of these mice and cut out the HIV. So these mice, now they're off of their ART, and about one third of them have no viral load. This is very big. As Dr. Khalili says, we now have a clear path to move ahead to trials in non-human primates and possibly even clinical trials in human patients within the year. And that, my friend, is very good news. The hunger hormone enhances memory. I'm sure you remember those mice. Remember the OB mice that had inability to sense ghrelin? Their ghrelin receptor had been knocked out. Gotta love those knockout mice. And they got very, very fat. So that hunger hormone was essentially identified as being, that was leptin, excuse me. Ghrelin is the hunger hormone, and leptin was the satiety hormone. Ghrelin is in the stomach, and when the stomach is stretched, it's released, and it goes to the brain, it reduces appetite. So ghrelin makes you hungry. If you do a gastric bypass on someone or remove part of their stomach, they have much lower levels of ghrelin, and that's partly why they lose weight. They can't eat very much anyway, but their appetite really shifts. Of course, over time, the brain puts out more receptors, and it's only a temporary effect, but it's partly what accounts for it. So in this study, because we know that ghrelin binds to receptors in the vagus nerve, they decided to see whether or not it could have an effect on memory function, because we know the vagus nerve, if there's high vagal activity, you tend to have improved memory up to a point. And of course, there's always that. There's always a except for in biology. So they thought maybe ghrelin would help the vagus nerve promote memory. So they used some rats and blocked the ghrelin signaling and gave the rats some memory tasks. And the ones with reduced ghrelin signaling were, in fact, impaired in tests of episodic memory that they had previously been pretty good at. And then when they stopped giving the blockage, they found that the mice reverted and did better. So the ghrelin may be something that allows for memory to be improved, and maybe we can find a memory-improving drug that doesn't actually cause us to want to eat. Maybe we could just hit half of those receptors. Another, while we're waiting for the researchers yet again to come up with the pill that's going to fix our brains, let's help us lose weight. Those seem to be the two big memes running around in the science space right now, because, you know, that's where the patents are. A short bout of exercise enhances brain function. Well, this was another mouse research, and this was a short-term exercise, not every day, just a one time. They took sedentary mice and put them on running wheels for a couple of hours, and then they looked at the growth of synapses in the hippocampus. And they were doing this by looking at genes in single neurons. And what they found was one gene in particular just got increased majorly by short bouts of exercise. And this gene encodes a protein that causes bending of the cell membrane of these neurons. And it promotes small little bumps on the neurons that are called dendritic spines. And dendritic spines are where the synapses start. So effectively, an acute burst of exercise kind of primes the brain and gets it ready to learn and remember something because of, and I could see adaptively, you know, biologically, if you just got chased or you were you suddenly had to exercise when you hadn't been exercising, it's usually because of a threat. And you'll want to remember that threat. You'll want to remember how you got away from it. So those little hands, almost hands reaching out across the vast space of the inside of the brain, looking to make a connection with other dendrites that were also dendritic spines that were also triggered at the same moment by the same stimuli to try to put together an associational pathway. So if you're trying to memorize something, taking a walk, and this is a 4,000 step walk, so that is what the equivalence was. So a couple of hours, if you're swatting for the test, if you're trying to study for a final, it would, or if you're reviewing for a board exam to cover people in my age bracket, it might make sense to take to go to the gym first and get yourself 4,000 steps on the treadmill or thereabouts, and then come home and hit the educational pathways and try and strengthen existing synapses and maybe even form some new ones. Our next study is about how repair of aging tissue can be either enhanced or inhibited by signals from neighboring cells. And this was looking, it's researchers at the University of Helsinki, and they were looking at the regenerative capacity of intestinal epithelium. As we get older, our gut gets older, and our gut replaces itself very rapidly. So we are, you know, in a couple of days, maybe 3 or 4 days, your the internal lining of your intestine has been sloughed and replaced. And that's about 10 times faster than the skin on your surface of your body. So it's really, really quick. A lot of our poop, the large bulk of our poop that isn't bacteria is actually sloughed skin cells from the epithelial lining. Now, there are lots of stem cells, and the stem cells rejuvenate the intestine. And whenever there's a problem, an injury, then the stem cells start to divide. And what researchers had noticed was that the older the cells, the less well they would repair themselves. And that's kind of a given. We see that in all kinds of tissues. But they were able to go deeper and find out what was going on. And what was going on was that there were that the cells, not the intestinal surface cells, but some other cells that we don't understand what they do, called Paneth cells, had changed what they did. And these Paneth cells were releasing a chemical that inhibited the stem cells. The normal signaling pathway that stimulates the epithelium is called the WNT pathway. Well, these Paneth cells were excreting something that suppressed that, and it basically inactivated the receptors so that the grow and heal signals could not be received as effectively. So even though those intestinal stem cells were just as strong and vigorous as ever, because they're immortal, they were being inhibited by these other cells. Being able to block that was an extremely effective reversal and restored healing. Now, even, and this was in cell culture, even young, healthy lining cells, even young, healthy intestines were inhibited if they were put next to the old Paneth cells. And I wonder, and I'm sure that the people who do this work will be looking at this research, I'm wondering if that compound that inhibits that WTN pathway could also be involved with why, when you do those blood transfusions and you transfuse young blood into an old mouse, you get an improvement in, you get an anti-aging benefit that seems to go well beyond just the oxygen carrying capacity of the blood. And we're still, of course, looking for the fountain of eternal youth. That's something I think that humans start looking for as soon as they realize that they're actually going to die. And, of course, that goes way back in mythology and folklore. With our science, because we're all rationalists, or so to speak, we have an irrational faith in science, I would say, but aside from that, we're rationalists. We are still looking for that meme, the fountain of youth. And it's interesting, as they delve down, they find useful stuff. I'm more interested in healing ulcers and healing tissues and allowing people to reach their full lifespan, not eternal, but maybe a collapsed period of decrepitude, so that when we shut off, we just, you know, come home from the golf game, put our feet up and go, rather than having years of decline and suffering before it happens. I think we have time for one last story. Let's use, since I have a pregnant niece right now, preeclampsia risk may be reduced by a healthy, high-fiber diet. A healthy diet rich in fiber is recommended, but it turns out that it could be critical for the health of children. So preeclampsia is a condition where you get high blood pressure, protein in the urine, and swelling in the mother. In the fetus, it causes impairment of the child's immune system. It effectively causes the thymus to not grow as well as it should. The thymus is really important for teaching you friend and foe. And so if you don't have a healthy thymus at birth, you're not able to respond to the environment, both internal and external, and it sets you up for having a higher tendency towards allergies and autoimmune disease later in your life. So in this study, they were getting to the basis for that, and it turns out that it's acetate. acetate in the bloodstream of the fetus is what stimulates the development of the thymus. And you know where acetate comes from? It comes from gut bacteria breaking down fiber. So it is possible that the rapid increase in the last couple of decades of allergies and autoimmune disease may be related to the low fiber and highly processed foods that have come to dominate our the American diet. Interesting research, and if you've got someone who's pregnant, make sure that they're getting plenty of fruits and vegetables. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.